Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Pathfinder 101 podcast.
Today's guest is Mr. Bradley Hicks, co-owner of Float Lab Technologies. Welcome to the interview and thank you for your time. Let's jump right into the questions.
Let's do it.
So before you became a co-owner of Float Lab, you were first in as a part of the SEAL team. So could you briefly explain your role in as a SEAL?
Yeah. So I joined the Navy in 2010 and I went through officer candidate school with a contract to go to BUDS, which is basic underwater demolition SEALs, which is the SEAL selection pipeline. And I had a pretty broad variety of jobs and kind of scopes of work during my about 10 and a half years. You know, my most recent position, I was, as we say, at Garrison, like when we're on base in San Diego or Coronado, I was a platoon commander, but then we deployed to Western Iraq where I was a task force commander. So the scope of that job was, you know, at about 20 to 22 SEAL operators, and then about probably 25 support personnel, people that ran, you know, the drone systems we used to get image intelligence of ISIS leaders that we're seeking to pursue, and a lot of, you know, various intelligence functions and all the kind of support personnel. And then reverse engineering from there, I kind of had this slow and steady progression of kind of career scope to get me to the point where I was kind of, you know, ready to be a commander downrange and, you know, kind of a pretty serious context as far as, you know, our job was to kind of hunt down ISIS leadership in Western Iraq. And then I got out early 2020 after that last deployment. And any more questions on that? Do you want me to touch on the stuff before my final role or?
Yeah, and also like, what were some of the factors that made you consider a career in the military over like other public sectors? And also like, how did you narrow down to, like, there are many different roles within the Navy itself. So how did you know that you wanted to become like a SEAL?
I first started noticing, I think my senior of high school, that I wanted, you know, in my eyes at that time, I wanted to kind of lead a life of service in some capacity. And, you know, at that age, at, you know, kind of 18, 19, you know, I was playing sports and I was, I kind of framed myself as someone who would be of service in more of like a physical capacity, i.e. like a warfighter, I guess. And so kind of with the spirit of, you know, serving our country, which there's many ways to do it that are not defense, that are incredible. But at that point in my life, I just felt like that was the only way I could do it. And as time passed and, you know, I went through college at UT Austin and I started to really kind of scrutinize the different paths to get into the military and live the life of whatever sort of warfighter. The more I dug into it, the more research I did, the more that I realized that the SEAL teams was my dream fit. And it was also my dream challenge. A big part of what kind of drew me to the SEAL teams was I wanted to find out, you know, how gritty I was, how resilient I was. I think part of me wanted to fail even just to kind of like prove to myself that I couldn't. But so I had these conflicting dissenting narratives in my head, right? Like one saying, you need to go find out that you're able to do this, that you're gritty and you're resilient and you can become, you know, someone great. And part of me was like, no, you're going to fail. And we all struggle with those voices all the time, right? And, you know, one of the beautiful challenges of life is trying to figure out how to understand that fear and listen to it, feel it, reduce it, and then listen to your optimism and focus on your resilience and strength and then applying it in all these different life contexts. But that was my first time to really hear that dissonance and or that dissent and pursue it. And I wanted to pursue it with the hardest training that the US military has, which is SEAL training. And so I wanted to go see if I could do it. I wanted to see if I had the grit in me. And I also wanted, you know, I wanted to be in a warfighting community, kind of from a sense of just primitive, you know, caveman DNA, which is nothing to brag about, but I'm very honest about. But I wanted the camaraderie, I wanted the brotherhood of a warfighting tribe. And, you know, at that time I kind of believed in what we were fighting for. You know, I have a different stance on it now, but I only knew what I knew at that point in time. And yeah, it provided me, you know, everything I was looking for and beyond my wildest imagination. And I have the fondest memories of the SEAL teams, not the fondest memories of the dark and super painful moments of SEAL selection. And but yeah, it always, the SEAL teams are just always the, at some point when I was maybe 21 or 22, I was a sophomore or junior in college, and I had my eyes set on it. There was no one doing that. You know, I couldn't look at any other branch opportunities and pursue them, because I knew that the holy grail to me was the teams.
How did you in college narrow down the major that you wanted to pursue, and what other majors might still be relevant to what you do today?
I actually just kind of followed what I was passionate about. I had a very curious mind about, you know, I had a kind of an anthropology centric curiosity. I wanted to understand what made humans the way we are, how civilizations were formed, how governments shaped civilizations, you know, how history was written. I just want to understand all that. So I started taking kind of a lot of classes that were history, government, anthropology, science. So I had a broad liberal arts aperture. And I think I had a double major of Latin American studies and history. I had a really curious eye for South America, just understanding the strong and just beautifully deep cultural roots of the indigenous peoples in South America. And then the fascinating kind of refiguration of the human landscape after the 15th century. And I wanted to understand kind of how culture was there the way it is today or at that point in time, which largely kind of reflects some similar issues that we have here in the US. So I was just really drawn to kind of understanding Latin American history. And I really wanted to learn a second language, and I was really passionate about learning Spanish. And a lot of those classes were taught in Spanish. So it was just like a win-win. But I think going back, you know, I probably wish I would have taken more engineering and kind of hard science courses and less of the kind of the qualitative stuff. But I think you have a good balance of kind of the qualitative and quantitative engineering and the history or the sociology and mathematics. You know, I think getting college is a chance to be a sponge and follow your pursuits and see what you're passionate about, see what you're not passionate about, and just kind of round out your intellectual toolkit in certain ways, and then find out kind of what opens up as your next step. I don't think anyone should have a fixed career in mind in college. And if you do, that's awesome, because you already have a passion. But it's a chance to kind of just, if you have the ability to, you know, take 4 years to be a sponge, which is a different conversation, because I think that model's largely broken for how expensive college is. But, you know, it should just provide an opportunity to find out kind of what your intellectual curiosities and passions are, and how to kind of start to leverage certain strengths you have at that point to find meaning and an impact within that realm.
And on the topic of like exploration of different careers in college, what different types of like summer jobs or maybe internships are available to explore like the military? And did you like utilize any of those to further narrow down which like branch you wanted to join, and whether it was like the SEALs were right for you?
I had a pretty standard like internship experience. I standard for kind of the world. I grew up in a family where my father had a private equity investment firm. And so I just kind of had a lot of tethers in the financial world and like the investment world. So I did an internship at a hedge fund with like a family friend that was kind of unrelated to military. But what it kind of taught me is I didn't want to go work at a mutual fund or a hedge fund. And then I did a internship with the Attorney General of Texas at the time, which was actually the current governor, is Greg Abbott. And then one summer I went and did a backpacking trip through South America, a solo backpacking trip. But I think, you know, if you go to if there's guys listening to this that are considering going into one of the service academies like West Point or Naval Academy or Air Force Academy, or even if you want to go to a regular school and do the ROTC programs, they set you up to do summer, I think they're called summer cruises, NROTC, Navy ROTC. You would get like 2 weeks on a destroyer in like Norfolk or San Diego, and they'd do like daytime exercises, or a submarine, or you'd be attached to like an aviation squadron where you'd learn how, you know, certain aviation platform squadrons do their daily battle rhythm, how they kind of tactically operate, how culture exists within different communities within, in this case, the Navy. And those are, you know, those are great because it helps you narrow down what you want to do when you graduate from one of those academies. So to answer your question, for people who are looking at this space, I think your best bet to get any sort of real exposure to what you want to be doing within the military would be to do like the ROTC or NROTC programs, and then, you know, they automatically set you up to do those summer cruise experiences.
Could you talk a little bit about how your daily responsibilities changed as you progressed through like the SEALs?
Yeah, you know, it's a low slope lineup where, you know, when you're a new guy at a SEAL team, there's a lot of kind of daily routine stuff that's meant to keep you humble and in check. And without really going into detail what those are, they're very effective tools to, you know, you finish SEAL training and you have your trident, you know, this coveted symbol that we have, and you feel like you're on top of the world, right? And then you go to a team and there's people that have been there for 20 years and they've been on 7+ combat deployments. And they don't care if you're, you know, somewhat trained and able to contribute in some capacity, but they don't want you to be cocky. So they have humility tools. So, you know, when you're a new guy, the scope can be stuff from cleaning toilets or whatever to, you know, very intense, complex, high risk tactical training. And the tactical training is always kind of bread and butter. I'm just saying that the scope can be broad, but the training, it's all things related to knowing how to do close quarters combat, close quarters battle, like clearing a structure that might have, you know, an unknown or a bad guy and a lot of unknown threats, maybe some hostages, and understanding how to aggressively move through that compound with kind of swift, deliberate, aggressive, but safe tactical execution. How do you move, you know, 2, 3, 4, 20 SEALs through a building and have them figure out a very complex human landscape as far as bad guys, unknowns, good guys, and have them go through and solve that tactical problem set while not shooting each other. So with that kind of bread and butter focus that we did, there's a lot of training around close quarters combat and then all the kind of ancillary tactics that kind of get you to that point, i.e., you know, jumping, skydiving with all of your tactical gear, or, you know, very kind of high speed vehicle platforms that we use to get to targets, or the maritime piece, you know, underwater or, you know, above water, certain boats we use, but all the kind of the infiltration platforms and capabilities that we'd have to get to a target. And then once you get to a target, a really broad reach of different scenarios that you could face, and to train through those scenarios so that you get so many different looks at different scenarios, and you train hard so that whenever you're in a situation in real life, downrange or on deployment, you've kind of been tested and you have some sort of cohesive flow with your unit. And so a lot of what we would do would be in spirit of those things. And I guess the bread and butter underneath all of it is a lot of shooting. A lot of time at the range, shooting, you know, dynamic ranges, different moving, shooting, and communicating always, and all the nuance that goes with that. And then just as, you know, my own career, I'm the new guy doing the humility chores to a lot of the beginning tactical stuff to, you know, getting to a point where I was kind of more of like an intel focus, leading a cross-functional team of different intelligence capabilities, you know, did that for a few years. And then I was an officer. So the whole idea is to get you kind of groomed and comfortable so that by the time you're in a commander position, you have a lot of the fundamental tactical skills. You have enough experience with all the different support functions that make a task force function so that, you know, you can effectively understand all the processes that you need to be familiar with to command a task force downrange.
Can you talk a little bit about, I believe you were talking about this earlier with like the BUDS thing, but could you talk a little bit about some of the selection criteria that they use for like picking SEALs? And because I was talking to someone else who was also in the Navy, and they're talking about like going into intel versus like some other different options, and they decided to pursue one over another because they wanted to actually like be in the field, like on a ship or on a plane, something like that. So what are the different criteria they use? Is it just completely like merit-based or like your physical ability-based, or are there other criteria that come into play?
Before anyone shows up to BUDS, you're pretty closely screened. and they make sure that I think there's some pretty basic, you know, psychological screening processes to make sure that you're, you know, mostly psychologically sound. And then being able to be fit, like physically fit at a very high level, that's critical because they don't want to waste anyone's time. And there's a lot of money that goes into training, selecting and then training SEALs. And they don't want people showing up that are not able to physically perform at the speed and crazy pace that BUDS operates. So the criteria are just extreme physical fitness to get into BUDS, and you know, some standard mental resiliency tests, that whatever they can test before you're actually in. And then when you go through selection, I think it's the most hardened, and I just don't think there's any sort of recreation of testing someone's grit like that and like a physical emotional sense than BUDS. And everyone who's there and BUDS is doing it so that they can be in the field. They're doing it because they want to be, you know, at the tip and be, you know, in a warfighting community that's, you know, and you need that physical and mental grit to, you know, overcome certain really challenging, austere, tough situations that naturally come in war zones. I think I answered your question.
Then what were some of the factors that influenced your decision to leave the SEAL program and sort of enter into the more like private sector?
For me, before my last deployment, I began learning my meditation discipline, which is a very fundamental, basic practice called transcendental meditation, just sitting upright, hands in your lap, eyes closed for 20 minutes and twice a day. So right before my last deployment, I started learning TM. And about halfway through my deployment, after, you know, at this point, probably 4 to 5 months of daily TM, it was the first time that I'd created enough stillness in my life to really kind of gain acute awareness of my thoughts and my feelings. And I started to, for the first time, find dissonance in my heart, dissonance in my mind. And I loved deeply, and I still deeply love all the guys I was with. And, you know, we stay in touch pretty much almost every day. And I deeply love the community and the mission. But I realized somewhere in the middle of that deployment, through creating stillness from meditating, I realized that dissonance I was feeling was kind of me realizing that it was time for me to move on. I felt like I wasn't as happy as I could have been and wanted to be. I felt like I needed more. The purpose is always there in the SEAL teams and the challenge is always there, but I wanted new purpose and new challenge. And I wanted to kind of loosen and lighten a lot of the, you know, kind of dark forces that I was carrying around. Have to kind of be angry and aggressive and all these things to be in that sort of community. You just have to be. You can't be expected to go be violent and be ready, be in a war fighting community, be ready to go to war all the time if you're not kind of carrying some of that dark stuff. And I was ready to get rid of it. I started to realize that when I was getting deeper in my meditation practice. So about halfway through that deployment, I decided that I was going to get out when we came home. And for me, you know, the path towards private equity was largely because it was just what I knew, because I grew up, you know, my old man still has a investment platform, and it was just, you know, dinner table conversation every night, my whole life. And so like, I felt very familiar with it. I was comfortable. I enjoyed the scope of that conversation, and had a really strong relationship with someone who founded a private equity firm called Redbird. And he was a mentor and friend, and it was a perfect fit for me to transition into his firm. You know, I learned soon after that was not the right fit for me and what I wanted to do and where I wanted to go, and what made me, you know, energized and passionate. But beautiful learning experience, and I'm very grateful for it. But I did about a year and a half of private equity after I got out of the teams.
Before we completely move on from your SEAL experience to what you do today, just a couple of quick questions. So often in many careers, the non-technical skills, like the interpersonal skills, are often more important than the technical skills themselves. So did, when you were in the SEAL teams, what sorts of interpersonal skills did you have to develop, and what were some of them, like how did you develop the habits or attitudes towards like these learning these different skills, and what were some of those skills that were very useful in your day to day?
I think my ability to, ultimately I learned a lot of hard skills, and I really like strengthened my kind of disciplines I had, of course, after, you know, about 11 years in the military. But the foundation within me was laid at my time, or during my time at St. Mark's, you know, the pretty very rigorous academic curriculum that forces you to build that very rigid daily discipline of homework and managing your schedule across how many, you know, 5 classes at once, right? And all different homework loads and kind of self-paced reading and day in, day out, year in, year out at St. Mark's, and then sports, fitting in sports and all the off-field kind of workloads that come with that. I wish I could go back and be in more of like the academic clubs, because that's just such a great forum for collaboration and idea sharing and learning and elevating yourself. But I imagine it'd be the same, sports or an academic club. Like, point being, you start really learning how to manage your time and to build disciplines to do what you need to do to carry your weight and to thrive. So a lot of that was shaped at St. Mark's. And then, you know, my time in the teams, you have to become super disciplined in a lot of ways. And I think that discipline is, you know, it can be a superpower if you stay committed to it. And discipline, it's a pretty common quote. And I'm pretty sure this guy named Jocko created it. If he didn't, I'm sure people would use it for a long time. But he created a very succinct, powerful quote that discipline equals freedom, right? If you have the discipline to do what you need to do to become who you want to become, that gives you the freedom to make it all work out, to see things clearly, to have free time because you're not another work you need to knock out. And so I think discipline in a lot of ways is something that a school like St. Mark's is excellent at arming you with. And then I think it's just very important for people to, when you graduate and whatever you do after leaving school, but to always be cognizant of how important it is to maintain discipline, whether it's for a meditation practice or for exercise or for reading, you know, just disciplines in every way. It's kind of what it's important. You don't want to be too tethered and like completely like boxed in. Like, it's good to have a very curious mind and be untethered to a certain degree, but having that kind of one foot on the ground, tethered and disciplined is a great kind of disposition to be in.
So, great point. Great advice. And then sort of the transitioning period into like the next part of your life. Before we move on to that, so you went to UNC for an MBA. And what were the factors that made you want to pursue an MBA? And could you also like talk about like in terms of the timeline, like when did you pursue the MBA?
I did an online MBA program at UNC, which I think I did over about 3.5 years. And I did it before, you know, my last year in the teams was super demanding, or year and a half was super demanding as far as time, you know, like my time requirements. But like the year and a half before that had kind of more cushion and flexibility. So I like for the year and a half before I took that kind of task force commander role, I heavily dug into this online MBA, and I did, you know, some really long days for about a year and a half and got most of it done, and then spread out the rest over about a year and a half, 2 years. So it was all online with some, you know, weekend long gatherings and kind of immersive experiences. But I did it because there's certain lulls, you know, there's periods where it's just extremely demanding in the teams, and there's periods where there's lulls, and it's great for guys who have families. You know, there's a lot of dads and husbands single and a non-father, and I was finishing work early and had a lot of downtime. So I was like, okay, cool. I heard there's an online MBA. I wanted to kind of learn, you know, soft and hard skills that would be applicable in the business world. And UNC had this amazing program and, you know, respected business school and the VA and taxpayers pay for it. So I took advantage, and yeah, it was really hard. At times it's really hard because it's, you know, you're doing it on top of a job. And I think it was not necessarily the most efficient and effective use of time. I think there's a lot of inefficiencies in online programs, but all in all, there was a lot of positive came from it.
And after leaving the Navy, you talked a little bit about a mentor / friend who helped you sort of transition into like private equity at Redbird. How was like, what were some of the different challenges you faced transitioning out, and how did you like overcome those? And then after that, could you just briefly talk about your own business, FloatLab?
I think honestly, there wasn't a challenge at first. It was super exciting, you know, having a new scope of work, and I felt much more free. Even, you know, the SEAL team, we think we're mostly freaks. I would show up in board shorts and t-shirts and sandals to the team a lot for work, and you know, didn't really have to cut our hair that much. But still, like, you don't realize how unfree you are until you get out of military and you really feel free. So I was like super excited to be at Redbird, and I was very free. And it was really demanding as far as, you know, I was on all these different like deal teams, and they were trying to teach me and get me well versed in all the sectors that we were invested in. So it was definitely like a drink from a fire hose at times, but I still felt very free and happy. So, you know, of course, it's a challenge when there's a new kind of a whole new paradigm of work with new language and new processes. So I was in that struggle, but I was stoked to be in that position because I love learning, and I was excited to be more free, and you know, and the culture of Redbird was great. But I also, as my meditation practice compounded, and I started to, you know, gain very, very acute self-awareness in ways I never had before. I began to get more and more clear on kind of what really energized me, what made me feel passion, and what made me feel aligned, and what made me feel authentic. And after 6 months, I kind of knew that it wasn't going to be in a corporate gig at a private equity firm. But I stayed for a year and, you know, 6 months because I felt deep reverence for the founder of the firm that gave me the opportunity. And I love the guys and girls I worked with. But ultimately, I wanted to get on a path towards authenticity and passion. I wanted to wake up energized, be doing what I was doing, and, you know, go to bed energized about what I was doing and just work all in between, but not have my work feel like work. And you can, I think, get there when you find out what you're passionate about, and you can make your kind of vocation become a vacation, i.e. like it never feels like work when you're doing something that you love. And I'm just now kind of getting to that point, 37, and I'm grateful to be in a position where I'm committing my time to now. And Float Lab is a part of that. You know, we're the superior manufacturer of just complete sensory deprivation experiences. And meditation is my kind of favorite pursuit in life. I love learning what goes on inside my head and listening to the different voices and ideas that I have. And I just love the art of understanding the inner processes that we have and getting to a point where I think more and more clearly. And these chambers are, you know, when you're sitting upright, you're meditating, in my normal team position, I'll start to feel blood pool in my butt. I'll have my cat hit my leg. I'll hear a siren outside. Something that always happens takes you out of that meditative state, right? When you're in a chamber and you can't feel the liquid because it's at skin temperature. By the way, it's based on a salt and magnesium. It's really good for your bloodstream to absorb, but you can't feel the liquid. So there's no gravity, complete visual deprivation. There's no light, zero, and completely soundproof. So no audio input. So there's just nothingness. And if you're in there for an hour to 2 hours, you're going to get to know yourself in ways that you never did before. And my mission in life is to make these ubiquitous and economically accessible for everyone. Whether you're the lowest earner, the janitor of the Fortune 500 company, or the CEO of the Fortune 500 company, like, you'll be able to afford to float in our centers. And, you know, so I'm spending a lot of my time right now figuring out how to make, you know, the business model change so that they are economically and physically accessible to everyone. You know, and I'm working on that and four or five other ideas and platforms that I'm kind of principal in that are in the spirit of kind of health and wellness and making an impact on the world and helping people kind of live happier, healthier, and better lives. And if I wake up after my kind of meditation routine and stillness routine, and I do, when I work towards that from 7 or 8 in the morning or whenever until I go to sleep, even if I only sleep, you know, 6 hours, it doesn't feel like work to me, even if it's all work in between. And that's kind of where I am right now, which again, I feel very grateful for. And of course, it's going to change a lot between now and next month, the next year and 10 years, but I'm kind of just in that groove and continuing to lean into things that are authentically what I believe in and what I want to be a part of.
You were talking about earlier, St. Mark's laid the foundation for like discipline and your like SEAL experience built on that. Could you talk a little bit about how that discipline maybe allowed you, or how does the discipline like vary once you came out of the government or public sector? Did it allow you to just accomplish like a lot more work than other people you were working alongside, maybe at Redbird, or was there like, what were the advantages of developing that discipline that is like we've seen in other places?
Redbird is a machine. Like the people that work there, you know, they were in the trenches at investment banks for, you know, 2 to 4 years, and then other private equity firms, just like grinding away for 12 to 15 hours a day on Excel and PowerPoint. And I couldn't touch that. Like, and I hated that scope. I wouldn't say I had any leg up on discipline, you know, against Redbird folks. You know, if anything, they, you know, they were all disciplined, and there's a culture of discipline there. And when there's a culture of discipline, shit kind of gets done and people are, you know, productive. And then it comes down to, cool, can you be disciplined but all be cohesive and respectful and open-minded and participative. But I think now that I'm not at a firm and I'm controlling my own time right now, I do think that the discipline that was established at St. Mark's and kind of forged further in the teams is an advantage. It's a huge advantage. And, you know, I think that, you know, that discipline, those are the rails that I'm confident, or I feel very confident, will get me to kind of where I want to get and make the impact I want to make. No matter what scope of work people are in, whether it's, you know, as a creative, you're an artist, or you're in finance at a firm, or, you know, whatever it might be, the discipline you learn and the self-reliability, self-accountability that you kind of, you build at St. Mark's is absolutely critical. And it's hard to see that while you're in school, because you're just like, you know, teachers are telling you what to do, and there's a lot of it. You have a lot of big workload, but, you know, it's if people can, if students can be cognizant of how much that's going to serve them later, it might make, you know, the workload and some of the things that are frustrating seem a little bit less frustrating. You know, with that in mind, maybe you can remind everyone that it's all for a greater cause and will serve you well.
You've given a lot of great advice so far. Sort of expanding on that, what is some extra advice maybe that you haven't given so far? What do you have for someone maybe in their junior year or senior year, or maybe just starting college, that's considering maybe like part one, considering going into the military, and then part two has like an idea or a passion like meditating for you that they want to pursue, but they're not sure exactly how to go about that?
I would say just always keep a curious mind and always seek truth. Be open-minded, be humble, be curious about how other people think, and listen to what other people say and listen to how they think. Don't try to just challenge all the time. Like, there's some amazing things that school can teach you that can give you like really important information and hard skills. But like, there's something about when you graduate from good schools and you're in academic environments that you gain conviction in what you've learned to the point where you start turning off to what other people think. And so it's always important to have a curious mind and to be humble in what you know. And if you're keeping the spirit of seeking truth and gaining understanding, then you'll always listen. And by the way, that means questioning all your teachers. You guys should be questioning your teachers. Be skeptical of everything you hear. Never take anything at face value. And that might be unpopular for teachers because they want to get their curriculum done and they want to do it efficiently and effectively. But if they don't let you challenge them, if it's in a respectful and polite way, which it always should be, then they're not being a good teacher. You shouldn't be teaching something that kids are just, or boys or girls are just in the, like, rote memorization. You should be helping them think deeply and critically about topics. So yeah, the most important thing I, you know, would say is just always keep that curious mind and always be skeptical of what you hear and continue to seek truth. That's probably not the best mindset to have when you go into the military, because it's the military, they want you to robotically follow orders, but do it to a certain degree. If you're going into the military, always be skeptical of what people are telling you to do. Again, always do it with humility and compassion and empathy when you're trying to learn and challenge. And then yes, you know, the best investment I think that anyone can make in themselves is building that meditation discipline, whether you're 13 or 73. The more you build that daily discipline, the more stillness that you create, the more you're going to understand your thoughts and you're going to understand your feelings and understand what drives kind of default network mode feelings for you and default network mode thoughts for you. The more and more, it's a practice that compounds on itself every day, month, and year. And the more you stay with it, the more you start seeing certain things that you do automatically and certain ways that you think automatically. And you might see them in a new way and think, oh, wow, I feel very grateful that I've learned that and think that way. But you might see other things and other ways of thinking that shaped you. And, you know, through experience in your life, where you went to school, how you're raised, or an influence someone had on you. And you might see that those forces no longer serve you because you're able to see how you think and how you feel with greater degrees of clarity when you meditate, especially after a long time, that you can start seeing, oh, okay, wow, this no longer serves me. And that way of thinking and feeling, that's not really that doesn't get me where I need to be. So I'm going to push that to the side. So it gives you that ability that's just hard to do. It's hard to get there unless you do create that stillness, right? Because you wake up and your conscious mind kicks in and you're working and you're stressed and just busy up until you go to sleep. And you just do that over and over again. You're not really seeing behind the curtain. So I think learning to see behind the curtain, learning to create stillness through a daily practice, a daily discipline. I like saying daily discipline because it takes discipline to do that. And it only works to the effect that it should if you're disciplined with it.
The last question I have is, if you're allowed to like share one of your SEAL experiences, what is your most memorable or something that really was an important memory to you from your SEAL team experience?
I've gone through, you know, some really unique, powerful experiences, I guess. I'm not going to choose one because I can't, but I can kind of touch on a couple. Let's just say there was some incredibly powerful experiences I had that where I failed. And my function of failure was a result of things I was kind of deficient in, skills or ways of being that I was deficient in. And I had some strong people early in my career kind of help me overcome those weaknesses and teach me things that need to be taught. And I say that, you know, because at the time it was extremely humbling and painful. And so those were, sounds terribly vague, I apologize, but I had to learn a lot of hard things that I don't think I could have learned in any other environment about myself. I lost two very, very close friends at different times. And that taught me this endless sense of just gratitude for life. I wake up every morning, you know, it's part of my kind of meditation mantra sequence, but I think deeply and feel deeply gratitude for life, for being able to breathe and have my vision, to have my hearing, to do the walk, to go outside and see nature. Like I feel so lucky. I feel it every day when I meditate. I feel that deep gratitude. I literally feel it in my heart, and that kind of starts my day. And I wouldn't have that if I hadn't lost two larger than life friends, you know, that were very dear friends in the SEAL teams. And you know, it's not a lesson that you want to learn through experience, but I learned immensely from, and I continue to, you know, harness it in a positive way every day. That's the only thing I can do. But I know you're looking for like a probably a deployment context, but I can't think of one right now that would be meaningful to share. But the one I will share is through tragedy of loss of life. It's the greatest tragedy that we can all experience as humans, is losing someone that we love, but making the most out of it and living your life with purpose as a response to it. And you know, gratitude is so important, and I feel deep gratitude just to be alive. So that's my greatest experience and takeaway.
On the topic of gratitude, thank you so much for your time and all the valuable advice you gave. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks to everyone who's listening for choosing to spend your time with this podcast. I really appreciate it. Please be sure to check out pathfinder101.com for more information like this. Thanks again, and have a great rest of your day.